And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Here's what's topping the news this week. Yesterday, the Dow Jones average hit an all-time high as the price of a barrel of oil dipped to a welcome new low of $58, while the 24-hour news channels were sleuthing into the emails of smarmy new excommunicated Congressman Foley, while news from Iraq sunk to a new low and North Korea prepares to test a nuclear bomb. Things are getting almost too complex. So today, we're heading to our national parks where great news is made every day. It's all coming up when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Today, we're heading into our national parks. Thank God for our national parks. Where the elk keep bugling, bison are bracing for the first big snows, retirees are driving the high roads in their RVs, school kids are in the fields, getting their hands deep into the complexities of stream ecology. And every day, 1,000 poets put pen to paper and scribe their souls into sonnets. Anytime you find the news out there getting perhaps just a bit over the edge, and you start yelling and waving your arms at Wolf Blitzer or Bill O'Reilly, well, always keep in mind that somewhere, not too far from where you are right now, there's a national park, your public lands, that are there for you, for your friends and family, for times just like these. Following the news, we're heading up to Sequoia National Park where we talk with Paul Despain, the park's cave manager, about a sensational new complex of caves that is being explored and discovered as we speak. In segment two, this past week, Congress confirmed a new director of national parks. Mary A. Bomar takes over the management of your public lands following what some felt was a difficult few years under the previous director. To find out about what Director Bomar may bring to the park mission, we head on down to Tucson and talk with Bill Wade of the Coalition of National Park Service Retirees, a group that knows a lot about our national parks. And then, in segment three, we travel back east to the Great Smoky Mountains and talk with citizen scientist Jason Love, who invites you to join the nationwide effort to tag and track the migrating monarchs as they are now on their legendary 3,000-mile flight to warmer climes in Mexico. It's a great show coming up, and it all begins following this week's news update. So now, the news. Energy companies bid $13.86 million for the right to explore for oil on 81 tracts of the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. Two Canadian companies dominated the bids. FEXLP, a subsidiary of Talisman Canada, and Petro-Canada jointly bid a total of $10.47 million to win the rights to explore on 48 tracts. The new sites are west of Teshekpuk Lake and just south of the Beaufort Sea coastline, close to leases already held by the companies. Of the 5.4 million acres up for lease, 3 million were withdrawn from the public sale to comply with the federal judge's ruling that barred oil and gas exploration in an environmentally sensitive wetlands. The sale brought in far less revenues than previous sales, which totaled $222 million from the last three sales. The State of Marine Environment Report released by the United Nations Environment Program, or UNEP, warned that toxic pollution to the oceans continues to increase, and the primary problem in developed nations is due to raw sewage. Whereas the oceans had historically been considered a viable dump for sewage, it is now well documented that the oceans are now in decline as a direct result of such practices. Currently, 80 to 90% of sewage entering the oceans is raw and untreated. Threatened areas include the North Sea beds, Coral reefs in Southeast Asia, wetlands in North America, Southern and Western Africa, mangroves in many Caribbean countries, Ecuador and Colombia, and fisheries in Latin America. The report documents that the number of coastal dead zones, the result of oxygen-depleted areas, has doubled every 10 years since 1960. President Bush called for a halt to all types of destructive fishing on the high seas Tuesday and vowed to work to eliminate destructive harvesting practices such as bottom trawling that destroys whole ecosystems on the ocean's floor. Bush's memo instructs the secretaries of the State and Commerce Departments to promote sustainable fisheries and to work to oppose fishing practices that destroy the long-term natural productivity of fish stocks or habitats such as seamounts, corals, and sponge fields for short-term gain. The mandate promises that the U.S. will work with other nations and international groups to change fishing practices and create new international fishing regulatory groups as needed. Currently, Brazil, Chile, Germany, the Netherlands, South Africa, and now the U.S. have expressed support for regulating bottom trawling on the high seas. Spain, Russia, and Iceland are nations which still oppose such bans. This week, marine conservation groups and a few U.S. senators hope to persuade the United Nations to ban bottom trawling anywhere where it is not regulated. The UN negotiations began Wednesday in New York. The National Park Service has a new director, confirmed by the Senate on Friday. Mary Bomar, a British native and career Interior Department employee, was nominated by President Bush on September 6th and confirmed this past Friday. Director Bomar succeeds Fran Minella, who is stepping down for family reasons. We'll be analyzing the new director during the second segment of today's show. And finally, following on the successes of the Earth Park in Cornwall, England, a massive indoor rainforest and environmental learning center will begin construction in central Iowa. Earth Park will feature an indoor rainforest, 600,000-gallon freshwater aquarium, an exterior prairie and wetlands exhibits. The main dome will enshrine 4 acres under a 150-foot-tall canopy. The new Earth Park is designed to be one of the world's greatest classrooms, and through that classroom, visitors will learn much more than awareness and appreciation. They will learn how to take action as stewards. We'll be featuring a discussion of Earth Park on next week's Wild Side News. And that's the news. And a few reminders. Now, I happen to know there are literally hundreds of new listeners to the Wild Side News. First, thanks for tuning in. And be prepared for an amazing diversity of topics each week that reflect the grand diversity of nature in our world. Now, if you haven't yet taken a look around the Wild Side News website, be sure to visit the archives, which you can access from the front page, as well as reviewing our most recent shows. We also have featured collections about animals, saving the planet, recreation, and art. And what you're going to discover is that the world's most amazing advocates for nature and sustainability, protection of the wonder, come here each week and share their voices. Now, you can listen anytime from anywhere in the world. It's great to have you joining our network. Tell your friends. Spread the word. The Wild Side News is catching on. If we are to find the common will to unite on a global basis to restructure our dreams of how we're to live together, we must come together and talk. That's what we do each week. I look forward to a lot of journeys together in the weeks and months ahead. So let's get on to today's focus on our national parks. Fall is in the air, and one of the grand places to visit at this time of the year is one of the legendary national parks in the American park system, Sequoia National Park in California, known for its extraordinary trees, legendary Sequoia trees. But there's another thing happening in Sequoia right now that I think a lot of people weren't that aware of, but it's making big-time news. And joining us now from Sequoia National Park is Joel Despain. Joel, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you very much.
Well, now, you have a unique title for Sequoia National Park. Tell us what you do.
I'm the cave management specialist here at the National Parks.
And that would suggest that there's a reason for you to have that title. Sequoia has caves.
Indeed. In fact, we have actually about 240 caves known here at the two national parks. That includes the longest cave in California and a number of the other longest caves in the state.
So what does a cave manager do? Are you actively pursuing caves? Do you do cave research? What's involved in your day-to-day?
Yes, I think of what we do is really sort of having two components. One is protection and management. We put cave gates on sensitive caves. We issue permits for cave visits. We do restoration work in our commercial cave here at the park. And then the other half of what we do is cave research. We research the variety of resources that are found in caves, whether those are mineralogical, hydrological, animals, cave wildlife, lots of unique species. So those sorts of things are what keep us busy.
Part of that ongoing research is the quest for new caves, and apparently there are groups that assist you on an amateur basis. That is a lead-in to today's story. Describe what has happened in the last few months.
Late in August, a group of four cave volunteers for the park, affiliated with the Cave Research Foundation, did discover a significant new cave here in Sequoia and Kings Canyon. Now, we do find new caves fairly often, but most of the time they're 20, 30, 40, 50 feet long, pretty short, and aren't particularly compelling, don't really contain that many interesting features. This new cave, which has been called Ursa Minor, is quite different. It features very large rooms, large passageways, beautiful cave formations. We already know that there's a whole host of cave-adapted animals inside the cave. There are clearly significant animal remains inside the cave that might be of some age. And so we've really found a very significant new cave here in the two parks this time around.
I've done a little research on how the cave was discovered, and that's quite an interesting story all by itself.
The cave was found, by a group of people who were looking for caves. We have an ongoing park-approved research project here with the Cave Research Foundation folks. And they actually were doing small-scale excavations. They were digging in likely places where they thought they might be able to access the cave. And, of course, it requires some careful thought about the geology of the area, the hydrology of the area, and where a cave might be hidden. And even combined with that, though, they certainly got lucky to find such a significant and nice cave as Ursa Minor.
Mm-hmm. Well, from what I understand, the clue was an opening the size of a softball. Let's take it from there.
The opening was about softball size, and Scott McBride, a caver from Central California, he had a flashlight along, and he could look through that hole and see back a ways. The number of feet, it was dark. And also, that hole had a particular shape to it, one that really indicated the type of solutional erosion that is how cave passages form. And so he thought it looked good right off the bat. And then the cavers spent a number of hours, so three or so, they made one trip back to get some more equipment and came back again for some more time to open up the cave and to allow access. And then immediately the entrance does go into a rappel, so they also had to get a rope and do that in order to enter the cave.
What was their first sense of the significance of this cave?
They were immediately excited and immediately realized that it was significant. As you go down the rope from the entrance that they opened up, you're in a nice cave passage, maybe 8 feet tall, 4 feet wide. It just is a very pleasant sort of, you know, body-sized passage or so. And then you suddenly go around a corner while you're still on rope, and you come out into the wall of a canyon that's 75 feet tall and 30 feet wide.
Wow.
And you can look off into blackness in one direction that's framed by these stalactites and other cave formations. So even on the rappel in, you realize that this is something quite significant.
I'd almost think you'd be afraid to enter in the sense that everywhere you step, there's wonder.
In a sense, there is. And these guys, I must say, did do a very good job on their first entry about being really careful about where they walked. You'll find that particularly these days, and particularly with newly discovered caves, that most people in the caving community are kind of aware of how they need to behave. Everyone walks in a single file line. You don't just wander over to features. You look very carefully at where your feet are placed. You make big efforts to not transport or move sediments and dirt back and forth from areas that are muddy to areas that have nice sparkling cave formations. Now we've actually gone in and defined trails. We have routes we want people to follow through the cave that are more robust and that will ensure that we do the absolute minimal damage and disturbance possible.
Well, with this kind of historical perspective on how the cave was discovered, now let's talk about what you have discovered. All reports are that it's a spectacular find.
It's a beautiful cave. The word I keep coming back to is aesthetic. It's just got beautiful shapes and forms. The rooms are large, which is unusual around here. A lot of our caves have many small, narrow, meandering passages. These are big, roomy spaces, and across all of these spaces, you just have sparkling floors that just glisten under your light. And hanging from the ceiling are long drapery and curtain-type formations that are very pretty. One of the rooms has a very large lake that sort of is divided into two lobes that's probably almost 100 feet across, and it's just a beautiful blue water down inside this lake. It is a seasonal lake. It's not completely full this time of the year. And other rooms have just beautiful displays of cave formations, beautiful pools, and wonderful things hanging from the ceiling. It's just a very pleasing, beautiful place.
Well, it's a large cave.
Large in terms of passage size. It's not a very long cave yet.
You've so far identified about 1,000 feet, but have you reached the end point yet?
We definitely have not. There are several places where cave passages continue, we can tell. And we've not chosen to follow those at this time, pending some good evaluation of what we already have. And we're trying to make sure we have everything well taken care of for what we've already seen before we go off into uncharted areas.
Can you give us a sense of the nature of the structure of the cave? I know that it has a series of rooms.
Yeah, it does have a series of rooms. They're essentially sort of two very large rooms sort of right off the bat. And from the first room down to sort of a lower right-hand side, there are some pits, some other rope drops, that area remains unexplored. To the left of that first room, there's a side passage that has many beautiful cave pearls in it. Then from the second room is the room that has the lake. From there are also a couple of side passages. One goes up to some upper back rooms that are very pretty, and another one goes to a climb, an area where the passage goes vertically, where we need to do some climbing to reach what is clearly an upper-level continuation.
Any evidence of existing animal life in the cave, which is always an exciting arena?
Yes. We also recently here at the National Parks completed a inventory of the wildlife living in Park Cave. And we actually were very surprised and pleased to realize that we had a whole series of new species, many of which were cave-adapted. And it appears that three of these new species of cave-adapted animals have been seen in this new cave. So we already know that the cave is significant in that it contains species that are endemic to the park and to the cave systems of the park.
Mm-hmm.
And very likely, with more research, we may very well find species that are unique to this cave. And that's a pretty common thing here we've begun to realize, that a lot of our larger park caves do have their own unique species.
In terms of the animals that you find inside of a cave, they must enter from the outside. They would have to. Any idea of how long they've been there, or even sort of cross-pollination between caves of a similar species, which would indicate some sort of connection?
There are a lot of possibilities for how these animals have come to be adapted to the park caves and to be in the park caves. And, you know, sometimes you can look at the individual animal and figure some of these things out. For instance, some of the animals in park caves, these animals seem to be using caves as a refuge. These are animals that whose closest relatives are found to the north in climates that are currently cooler and wetter, and in that sense more similar to the way the climate has been here in the past. Caves are also a cooler and wetter climate, and so compared to the way things are here currently. And so the cave environment can be a natural refuge for animals that are adapted to a little bit different climate than we have here currently. But we also have animals here where we have a surface species, and then in a series of caves, each cave has its own unique species that's adapted inside the cave that's related to the surface species. In other words, it's clear that the surface species had traveled into these different caves, populations developed in those caves, and unique species grew out of each of those populations in each of those caves. So it can happen in a variety of ways that the evolutionary process takes place and these animals become either isolated unique species or unique species with relatives relatively close at hand.
Well, in terms of the species that you've found so far, give us an indication of what they are.
In the new cave, we have a Striuridae millipede, a lithobiomorph centipede, which is a predator, and then also potentially a Calcina harvestman, which is a sort of a, like a spider but with a single body instead of two that most spiders have, like a daddy long legs.
Mm-hmm. Now, in many cases, cave species are albino and blind. Is that the case here?
It is the case here. Albino isn't really quite the right term. You know, that's a specific genetic situation.
That's true.
In this case, the entire species has lost its pigmentation, lost their eyes. They have elongated appendages quite often. And they also actually tend to have a very different sort of lifestyle. They tend to have fewer young at a given time and to live quite a bit longer than their surface-dwelling relatives.
Hmm.
And those are all adaptations to a low-energy environment.
How many species have you identified or found?
Actually,
let's say, discovered so far?
Mm-hmm. Total is 31.
Oh, that's
a lot. 31 new species of cave invertebrates we've found in the park caves in the past several years as the project's been going on.
There must be a sort of this incestuous feeding on each other. It's a closed environment.
Exactly, yes. And some of these animals are cannibalistic, so sometimes they'll even eat some of their own kind. And these are small communities. There's only a handful of species in each of these different caves. And so we are finding animals that are at all different parts of the food chain, and they definitely do prey upon each other.
Now, you also have a big lake, so have you had a chance to actually go underwater?
We have not. And that may be something we'll be doing in the future. The lake's pretty delicate. There's a lot of these cave formations lining its walls and bottom and things. But some diving in there may be appropriate in the future.
Of course, you could probably use some underwater viewing devices. I imagine.
Potentially so. Although we'd have to, anything like that, we'd have to take into the cave, which could be a little tricky.
Yeah. Well, let's talk also about this process of mapping. Of course, that's going to be a big part of this. What's involved? I mean, there's so many new technologies now. Probably things are really advancing nicely in that direction.
You know, we're still pretty much using 16th century technology, I hate to say.
My first thought was, well, this is going to be so much easier because of GPS, but probably GPS doesn't work under those situations.
It does not work underground because you can't really receive satellite signaling.
So you're back to ropes and other forms.
We use a tape, you know, a measuring tape, a compass, and a clinometer. And we make a series of straight line shots through the cave from point to point and record that data for each of those, and then that we create sort of a framework. And then from there, an individual with a lot of experience does a detailed drawing using standardized symbols from a legend to represent the cave's varied features.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, things like laser rangefinders are coming in big now, and they're already being quite helpful. In fact, we have used some of those on the survey at IRSA. And I probably one day we'll be able to enter all the data into a PDA and have it just beautifully plot the cave for us as we go. But we're just not quite there yet in terms of compact size, reasonable price, and robust enough electronics. But it's close.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these things are starting to be used in cave surveys now.
How long do you figure it's going to take you to survey this particular cave?
Well, to be honest, we're going slow right now. We've not quite surveyed everything that we've seen. We want to get that done. And I expect that will be completed this fall within the next month. Beyond that, it will just depend how long the cave is and how much more we find.
I'm curious. I'm a person who's intrigued with wonder and always liked that, the first new experience. What was it like for you personally as you entered this cave and suddenly realized you were in a place that perhaps, I don't know if you have any indication whether or not humans have ever been inside this cave, but perhaps no human has ever seen before?
We're pretty sure that there has not been anyone inside the cave before. There's still places where there are a lot of discoveries going on, you know. But for your average person to go somewhere where no one else has ever been, that's a rare thing. You know, unless you're an astronaut or a deep sea diver or something, that just doesn't happen every day.
Mm.
And it's really a big part of what caving is about and why caving, I think, is compelling to people, because you can go somewhere where no one has ever been, where you have no idea what you're going to find around the corner. And this cave was a big thrill in that way, because it was just immediately beautiful and big and compelling. The guys who had found it, you know, called me right away to tell me what they found. And these are experienced cavers. These guys, you know, they've been in a lot of caves, they've seen a lot of caves. And I could tell just from their excitement that this was something quite significant. And I went the next day.
Yeah.
I immediately wanted to see what it was they had seen and what had left them in such a pleased state.
As the cave manager, it's sort of, I can imagine it's almost like, okay, stand back, this is my realm.
it's sort of like, I've got a job to do and I'm excited to do it.
That's great.
It was a real good day at the office, as I say with my assistant.
Yeah, for sure. as you go into this cave, give me some of your aha moments. What really caught your attention? Where did you say, oh my gosh, that is sensational?
Well, I think for me, definitely that first entrance rappel. Like I said, you go into the entrance and it's a, you know, a nice little cave passage. It seems, oh, this is great. And then you come around the corner on the rope and it's like, holy cow. My jaw dropped when I looked off into the darkness from my perch up high on the wall into that 75-foot-tall passage going off into the mountain. I was just right off the bat there very, very taken aback and sort of realized why these guys were excited. Other things that struck me early on were the really beautiful floors. The calcite crystals that are found in the cave formations, found in the flowstones, are really large and particularly sparkly in this cave. And so the floors are just beautiful. The lake was also very exciting and just really impressive to see. Also the bones. And right there where you get off the rope as you come into the cave, there's a slope there where we also immediately found some of these cave-adapted animals. And so really just within the first half an hour, I was excited in a number of different ways and really feeling like we had a really significant find in our hands.
Now, did I hear you say bones?
Yes. There are clearly animals that have died in the cave, including one that's quite large. The name of the cave, Ursa Minor, to a certain extent, came from this because the animal resembles a bear.
Hmm.
We don't really know if it is a bear yet, and we'll have to, hopefully we'll have a paleontologist in there this fall to take a look at that for us.
Mm, that could be very interesting.
And there are bones in a number of other locations in the cave, too, that may very well be quite ancient.
Now, how is this going to affect our knowledge of cave formation? And why don't you give us a short version of how a cave like this is formed, and then how this may help advance the science?
Naturally, water under the ground is a little bit acidic. And this mostly comes from chemical processes in the soil. And acidic water, just a little bit acidic, I mean, less acidic than your glass of tea, actually has the ability to dissolve certain types of rock. And the most common type of rock people associate that with is limestone. And whenever you get limestone, you get sinkholes and springs and caves because of the way that water can erode this rock. Well, here in the Sierra Nevada, we have a little bit different version of the limestone. Here the rock is marble, which is beautiful rock, and it's also just the metamorphosed version of limestone. It's very much the same chemically as limestone, and so it erodes in the same way. Caves form by water moving underground, but that water is tied to surface streams. Caves end where springs form, where the water returns to the surface. Because of that, caves are closely tied to the landscape around them. And the elevation of a cave passage is determined by the landscape around them and by the elevation of the surface streams around them. So when you have an old cave, a big cave with multiple levels and such, that cave actually can give you a glimpse into geologic history. Here in the Sierra Nevada, the history of part caves actually can tell us a lot about the history of the mountain range. And part caves have been used to do this sort of work in the past, and Ursa Minor is going to be a great new place to do that sort of work.
Well, of course, now everybody wants to know, is the public ever going to see this cave in person?
You know, that's not really a question I can answer at all at this point. I mean, I think the cave is in a remote and isolated canyon. It does have a vertical entrance. I mean, there are a lot of challenges there. But really, you know, here at the National Parks, we've got a job, first of all, to figure out what we've got, to do a good inventory of the cave, to get good photographs of it, to understand the biology of it, to document its features. Once we know what we've got, then we'll go through a process of thinking about what's best for the cave and best for the park. You know, and that'll be a planning process and maybe part of an upcoming cave management plan for the parks. And, you know, through that whole process, we'll be talking to local people and anyone who's interested, people who are cave enthusiasts for sure. And from that point on, we'll be deciding a course of action long term. We won't make any snap decisions about what we're going to do with this cave. We'll go through a long process and let people comment and let them be involved.
How often are you able to actually head into this cave?
We're going, trips into the cave are only when there's a good purpose to go, and we try to get a lot done. Every entry into the cave could potentially cause some damage or disturbance that's not necessary. So we are going when we've typically got some of our cave volunteers around. There's just myself and one other person on our staff, and we're more efficient when we have more people. So when those folks are available and we've got a specific task at hand, then we'll go into the cave and do some more survey work, do some work on the trails, getting that well lined out, and things like that. The next big project will be week after next, and that's when we're going to put a gate on the cave.
Hmm.
We're actually going to go ahead and, at that time, we'll restore the entrance to that same size, that softball-sized hole that it was at originally, in order to keep the same airflow and climate and such inside the cave.
Interesting.
And then we'll make a removable component of the gate so that people can enter, but then the gate will be in place so that we can secure the cave.
Oh, very interesting. So you have to keep the climate the same.
Yep.
I suppose you've done some extensive monitoring on the humidity and temperatures and things of that nature.
We're just starting to do that at Ursa Minor. In fact, we've just been having a few little problems with that data logger. but we have done it for a number of other park caves, and we know that caves can often be very sensitive to climatic changes, and opening an entrance is one way to do that. Mm-hmm. You can dry things out is what would be our primary concern here.
Well, Joel, you're a lucky guy to be able to have access to such extraordinary wonder and be one of the first people to see such.
Well, thank you very much. I do like my job, and we certainly hope we very much do right by this cave.
Now, for people who want to follow this story, which will be emerging for the history of the National Park System onward and forward, what's the best way for them to find out more and follow the story?
You can check our park website, or to be honest, you can feel free to contact me at Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Park. Do you have specific questions? Or things you want to know about, I'm at JOEL_DESPAIN@nps.gov.
Well, it's been a great pleasure talking with you, Joel.
Thank you very much. It's very nice to speak with you, too, and it was a pleasure.
Our national parks are an endless natural treasury of wonder, or at least that's what we hope. The pressures have been building to change the nature of our national park system. This last week, Congress confirmed a new National Parks Director. And a lot of people are wondering what Mary Bomar will bring to the legacy of our national park heritage. We'll talk with someone who's given his life to that legacy and get his views on where we're going. So, don't go away.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.